Now we were speaking last time about the 14th century, and we've noticed how different it was in some ways from the 13th century. And we spoke of Raymond Lull as the end of the hour, as F. And then G we'll call Scholastic. The 13th century was the great century of the Scholastics. That was the century in which this group of men who we call scholastics, that is, the scholars who were primarily interested in questions about the nature of the universe and about the Christian interpretation of the universe and of theology. This group of scholars through the Middle Ages rose in the 1100s. In the 1200s, they reached their height, and they were definitely in their decline in this century. There were some who wrote on theological subjects and made some good contributions, but hardly to be compared with the number who studied very carefully in these lines in the previous century. And though some of their methods of interpretation are such as we would not accept today, and their vision was somewhat narrowed, and they left out a great deal that we think is vital, yet there is much in the scholastic that is still of value. As the movement went on, it degenerated, and most of the ridicule that people put upon scholasticism today would refer not to the great scholastics, but to the ones in the 14th or even the 15th century, when they felt that all the big questions had been solved, and they devoted themselves to arguing over matters on which the Scripture has given us no revelation and on which there's no way by observation that we can gain knowledge. But these present-day ridicules of the scholastics are not fairly applied to the whole movement, though some of its later members probably fall properly under this condemnation. But during the present century we're looking at now, the 14th century, the conflict between the claims of the Pope and the claims of the Emperor came more or less to a head in the reign of Pope John 22nd. And as a result, the clerical scholars gave a good deal of their attention to the studying of these matters and to the attempt to find what is the correct interpretation as to the authority of the Pope or the authority of the civil government. And in this century, the men who were ranked as the greatest thinkers, most of them took a stand against the papal claims. One of these was a man named Marsilius, M-A-R-S-I-L-I-U-S, Marsilius of Padua. Padua is a town in Italy. Those of you who are familiar with Shakespeare's Merchant of Venice may remember how Padua was referred to as the place from which you would expect an eminent lawyer to come. It was a great center, particularly of legal study in Italy. But Marsilius, though he came from Italy, spent the greater part of his life in France, where he was rector of the University of Paris. It is in those days, it was easier for scholars to travel around from one country to another than it is today. Although transportation was difficult, the linguistic difficulties that we face today were much less then, because all scholarship was carried on in Latin. And so a person who could lecture or discuss scholarly matters in one country could do it just as well as in another. And this gave a great advantage to the scholars, of course, with the ease of communication in any part of the Western world. But Marsilius, for many years, was rector of the University of Paris, and McSorley, in this Roman Catholic history, speaks of him as, he says that he supported the claims of the emperor, and McSorley says he went so far in subordinating the Holy See to the civil power that he is said to have startled even the emperor. He taught that all power comes from the people, who delegate part of it to the sovereign and part to the councils, popes, bishops, and priests. McSorley says his theory of the relationship between church and state has been called a crude pagan concept and heretical assault on the church's constitution. Now, it's interesting that McSorley, within this century, write that way about these theories, which they don't sound just like what we expect in the Middle Ages, but they certainly fit with the widespread idea today that all power does come from the people. I doubt, really, if Marsilius went quite as far as he represents him as having gone. But he says, condemned by a papal commission in 1327, he took refuge with the emperor, who made him imperial vicar. Other of these scholars, there's maybe a dozen of them of some importance in this connection, but the other who's outstanding in this regard is a man named William of Ockham. William of Ockham, O-C-C-A-M, an Englishman. A Franciscan who had studied at Oxford and Paris and became a teacher at the University of Paris. McSorley says of him, the Franciscan William of Ockham, regarded by some as the greatest intellect of his age, defended the right of appeal from the Pope to a general council, and held that the constitution of the church should be adjusted to the spirit of the times, and should therefore become monarchical, aristocratic, or democratic as political changes might require. That fits much more with the attitude of the Romanists today than it would have 20 years ago, the attitude of William of Ockham. But William of Ockham supported the emperor in his struggle with Pope John. He wrote a work called A Compendium of the Errors of John 22nd. The various men, of course, criticized very strongly Boniface VIII's official statement that all secular power is subject to the Pope. And they took strong issue with this. It was 200 years later when Luther began his great effort in the Reformation and found himself coming in conflict with the papal power, and he began looking back into the history of earlier times. He was quite surprised to find what a strong stand these men 200 years earlier had taken, and he quoted from them at length and made considerable use of their arguments. These men were in no sense doctrinal reformers. They were men who were interested in political affairs, particularly political affairs in the church. But their theories are strongly opposed to that which was the official position of the Roman church and which the Pope had been able to carry out to so large an extent, particularly during the 13th century, the century just before it. Now, during this century, the writing had become much more widespread than had been the case two or three centuries earlier. And turmoil which had been so great in Europe during several centuries after 450 AD was becoming considerably less. The church had tried to get people who were always carrying on during the Middle Ages, little fights and skirmishes and attacks and plundering expeditions, tried to get them to not do this on Sunday. And so they had succeeded in getting a rule made that they were not to plunder or fight on Sunday. And then by this time they had extended it until about half the week was much safer than it had been before. And while life was still not safe in most of Europe, yet it was far safer than it had been even two or three centuries before. And this contributed to the development of more intellectual activity of various kinds during this period than there had been before. Perhaps not the great intellects of the previous century, but a greater number of men who were writing and thinking along different lines. And so we'll mention, capital A, spiritual writers. And during this century and the next century, there are a number of men who wrote devotional works, some of which are very highly thought of to the present day. It is uncertain whether the book, The Imitation of Christ, was written during this century or during the next century. But it is a book of which Shaw says that with the Confessions of St. Augustine and Bunyan's Pilgrim's Progress, it occupies a place in the very front rank of manuals of devotion. The Imitation of Christ by Thomas A. Kempis. Now, Thomas A. Kempis lived in the latter part of this century and the early part of the next century. And I would not mention this until the next century, except that there are those who think it was written earlier, and that Thomas A. Kempis was only editor of it, that it is the work of this previous century. But Schaff says, Protestants and Catholics alike have joined in giving it praise. Dr. Samuel Johnson, once when ill, taught himself Dutch by reading it in that language, and said of its author that the world had opened its arms to receive the book. It was translated by John Wesley. It was edited by the great Scotch divine Thomas Chalmers. Gladstone said it was a golden book for all time. And Charles Hodge said that it has diffused itself like incense through the aisles and alcoves of the Universal Church. There have been over 2,000 editions of it. More than 1,000 editions of it are on the shelves of the British Museum. And the book has thus had a tremendous influence. It does not go into disputed doctrinal matters, but it puts its emphasis on a personal love of Christ, gratitude for Christ for what he has done, a longing to be united with the Savior. And it has had this tremendous influence. Whether it was written by Thomas A. Kempis or a little earlier, the group of which it is typical largely came into existence during the century at which we are now looking. There was one of them, Garrett de Groot, G-R-O-O-T-E, whom some think is the actual author of the Imitation of Christ. It cannot be proven. It certainly is usually referred to Thomas A. Kempis. But Garrett de Groot, G-R-O-O-T-E, formed an organization which he called the Brothers of the Common Life. And this was quite different from the monastic order. It never received any papal approval. It never sought or received it. At times, in the next century, there was a certain amount of opposition, but never great opposition to it, because it did not enter into doctrinal matters, but it was, like the Imitation of Christ, a great devotional movement. And it was not an order like the monastic orders in which irrevocable vows were taken. The Brothers of the Common Life. People might enter it and might leave it. And some of its members were clergy and some were laity. But they were men who put great stress on preaching and great stress on training of the young. They developed schools and they developed a certain amount of vocational training as well as training in the ordinary things that the schools deal with. They try to get emphasis put on the devotional life, the personal loyalty to Christ, making Christ primary in one's life and thought. And some of the writers of this period, of this group, wrote things that Luther had reprinted or had printed in his day. This is before printing, of course, but that he got out editions of and praised very, very highly. It would take us considerable time to look into the various writers in this period, and still more time if we were to try to analyze them and see how much there was that was good, that can be helped to us in their writings, and how much there is that simply reflects the general theological ideas of their day. We must remember this, that the great ideas are usually, once they are thoroughly understood, can be expressed very clearly and very simply. But that often, long before they can be so expressed, they are realized by many people and are effective but not clearly expressed. And therefore you can't always say just who has fully grasped something and who hasn't. And Luther's great contribution was to state the gospel in clearer language than it perhaps had ever been stated before. And with Luther's definite statements about salvation by faith, it makes it easy for us to say, this is definitely in line with scriptural teaching about salvation, and this isn't. But before him, we have a great many who apprehended the truth, though they didn't fully comprehend. And that is true in every line of thought. We gradually grope for truth, and then when we get the full understanding of it, we can't feel anybody could have been so stupid as not to see it in the first. It's true in almost any advance, in any line of human thought. But some of these thinkers of this period prepared the way for the Reformation, undoubtedly, with their devotional manuals and their love for Christ and their great adoration of Him and their realization of how much He had done, even though they didn't express it as clearly and plainly as we are able to express it since Martin Luther led the way in this regard. But we will not take time now to go into further details on the other individual spiritual writers of this period. Some of them are quite outstanding, but it's difficult to select those who would be worthy of our special attention. We'll go on to J, and perhaps spend a little more time on another movement which is not quite so important from the viewpoint of church history as this one, but which nevertheless had such a wide and continuing influence even to the present day that it's necessary we look a little more fully into it. And that we call J, the beginnings of national literature. The beginnings of national literature. During the Middle Ages, what scholarship there was in the Latin language. And as the time went on, naturally, those who would write felt that Latin was the language in which they should write. Even as recently as the beginning of this century, anyone who was educated, almost anywhere, was expected to be able to read Latin fluently. And that is brought home to you very plainly when you read Hodges' Theology. See how easily he quotes a page or a half a page of Latin, never dreaming but what all of his readers will, of course, be able to read this without any difficulty. There was a great advantage in that. But as time went on and the Latin language in various regions changed as people pronounced it, and you developed national languages, French and Spanish and Portuguese, Italian, Romanian, quite a number that developed out of Latin. And then as in Germany and the Scandinavian countries, people began to use their own native languages more for, not just for talk in the family and for ordinary life, but they began to do a little writing in their languages. We find in about the century we're looking at now, the beginning of writing things in the language of the which was spoken actually at the time, aside from scholarship. And there were certain men of great genius who did this, and whose writings have a great effect to the present day. Three of these men were in Italy, and so we will mention the beginning of the national literature first in Italy for these three men. I will simply number the men rather than to number the nations now. We will mention the first of these was Dante, D-A-N-T-E. Dante Alighieri is his full name. He began his life in the previous century and died early in the century at which we are now looking. And Dante is perhaps the greatest writer of Italian who has ever lived. And he's one of the great writers of all time. It is amazing how many people there are in this country who avidly sees any book written about Dante today, and how many there are who are studying it, particularly when you realize how difficult it is to get into it, because Dante deals extensively with the contemporary figures of his own time and of the previous two or three centuries. And in order to really understand him, you have to learn something about these dozens of characters, most of whom we know very little about otherwise. But he was a man of tremendous genius, and his works are probably among the half dozen greatest writings in the world's history from a literary viewpoint. Therefore, he had a great influence, and he comes more properly into church history than the next two we're going to speak of, because his greatest work, which he called the Divine Comedy, present the view of the afterlife, which was common in the Middle Ages. And many speak of Dante as having summed up the whole of the religious and theological viewpoint of the Middle Ages in his writings. And it's interesting that despite that, his writings are so widely read and loved today. Our American poet Longfellow translated into English the whole three volumes of Dante's Divine Comedy. And Dante was a man who came from Florence, the city in Italy which has perhaps produced more great men than any other city in the world's history, unless it be Rome. Certainly more than any other city in the last five centuries. It's probably the only century, well, it is the only city in the world that has half the world named after one of its citizens. It's produced more great artists and great men in many different lines than perhaps any other city. But Dante was a politician in Florence who stood with the party there that opposed the Pope. The city was divided into the two parties, those who wanted to be on the Pope's side and those who wanted to be on the Emperor's side. And Dante stood on the side that favored the Emperor, and as a result, fairly early in his life, he was exiled from the city. And he spent the latter years of his life wandering to other parts of Western Europe, eventually settling in another Italian town where he spent the latter years of his life in exile. He is thus not a man who was a strong defender of the papal claims. In fact, he opposed the papal ideas of widespread political control very strong. But he is not a man who opposed the medieval doctrine at all. And his principal book is divided into the Inferno, his trip through hell with the poet Virgil conducting him through, and then through paradise, and then through heaven. But many Protestants find that taking the book not as a picture of the afterlife, in which of course we don't believe in his idea at all of there being a purgatory, but as a picture of human life, showing the stage of sin and what it means, as pictured by his picture of hell, showing the stage of repentance and beginning to look for better things, and then showing the state of paradise, the state of being a Christian, they find, thus in a somewhat allegorical way, they feel they find great blessing from the book. But the interest of the book is largely due to his very dramatic pictures and to his very remarkable ways in which he presents so many ideas, and of course his very outstanding Italian poetry. Within the book was distributed in his lifetime, and within two or three years after his death, the people of Florence were beginning to declare that he was the great Florentine, and they demanded his body back to them. But they had exiled him, and the city in which he died kept his body and still has it to this day. So they have monuments of him in Florence, and within a few years after his death, they had chairs in the universities all over Europe for the study of his work. Dante, then, is the great literary figure who did so much to make the Italian language a literary language and also to establish high literary standards for the world. And his writing has certainly popularized and spread the ideas, the religious ideas of the Middle Ages, but also certainly did not contribute to the maintenance of the great claims of the Pope, many of whom he placed in hell, only one of whom he placed in heaven in his description. The second of these great writers of this kind, great Italian writer, who we should mention, is called Petrarch. Much less widely known than is Dante, and yet generally considered as the most cultured man of his age. A very interesting peculiarity of the Romantic writers of this time, I don't know whether it began with Dante and Petrarch imitated it, or whether it's whether they both got it from someone else. But when Dante was just a young boy, he saw a young girl in Florence whom he immediately fell in love with, and to such an extent that he revered her so highly that he could not bring himself to think of even speaking to her. So he saw her and admired her from a distance. He got a glimpse of her again about 10 years later, and he never saw her again. But he wrote poem after poem of expressing his love and adoration of her. He married someone else, she married someone else, and he never saw her again. But the poet Virgil conducted him in his poem to hell and purgatory, but Virgil couldn't go into heaven. But he was met by this girl whom he had seen those two occasions when he was a boy, and Beatrice conducted him into heaven and showed him all the wonderful things of heaven. Now, this second one, Petrarch, did the same thing. He, as a young man, fell in love with a girl named Laura, whom he admired from a distance. Never came to really know her. She married someone else, and he married someone else. He never had any contact with her except to admire her from a distance and write numerous poems in her honor. And all his life, she enters into his writing. But Petrarch was a great writer and a great student of the ancient classics. He tried to get manuscripts of the ancient classics, and this is something which was hardly known in his day. He's been called the inaugurator of the Italian Renaissance. He admired the Greek and Roman authors so much that he spared no pains to secure old manuscripts. Now, during the Middle Ages, in order to keep the monks busy and to keep them out of mischief, often they were simply given manuscripts to copy without paying much attention to what was in them or their meaning or anything about them. And so there were copies of some of the old classics here and there in monasteries in Italy and elsewhere, and Petrarch tried to gather them and to put the material together. Yes? P-E-T-R-A-R-C-H. P-E-T-R-A-R-C-H. He visited Avignon when the popes were at the height of their splendor there, and he wrote in most scathing terms of the low moral nature state of things and the great wealth that was lavishly spent on pleasures and the other things which he strongly criticized in Avignon. But he never actually opposed papal medieval doctrine, and he was interested primarily in literature rather than in religion. But he gave an impetus to the beginning of the Renaissance movement, which was so important later in preparing the way for the Reformation. Now, the third of these Italian writers who had great influence was a man named Boccaccio, B-O-C-C-A-C-C-I-O. And Boccaccio was somewhat younger than Dante. He was about the same age as Petrarch. He, like Petrarch, was tremendously interested in ancient classics, ancient manuscripts. He tells of how he made a visit to the old monastery in Monte Cassino, which was where the Benedictine order had been founded nearly a thousand years before. And when he asked to see the library, he said a monk took him to a dusty room without a door, with grass growing in its windows. And many of the manuscripts were mutilated. And his guide told him the monks were in the habit of tearing out leaves to be used by the children or sold to women for amulets for their arms. And here was this material that had been copied and which preserved about all that had been kept of the great ancient classics being treated in this way. But Petrarch and Boccaccio began to take an interest in it, and others followed their example, and a certain amount of the literature of the ancient world has thus have been preserved. Incidentally, Petrarch, whose writings in Italian were highly treasured, himself thought that they were very minor. He thought his writings in Latin were much more important. He wrote a great deal in Latin, which today, of course, is hardly looked at. But in Italian, he had a great influence. Now, Boccaccio has had probably a greater influence than Petrarch, and his influence has been, on the whole, rather bad. He wrote a book called The Decameron, which contains 100 stories told by people who had fled from Florence during a pestilence. And these people, living in a beautiful garden several miles from the city, begin to relate stories about to amuse one another. And these stories range from moral tales to indecent love intrigue. One of them tells about a Jew named Abraham, who, refusing to comply with appeals to turn Christian, went to Rome to study the question for himself. And the story that Boccaccio gives says that this Jew found that priestly morals were so corrupt, cardinals with concubines, reveling in riches and luxury, he concluded Christianity must have a divine origin or it would not have survived when the center of Christendom was so rotten. So he decided to become a Christian. McSorley speaks about Boccaccio and about his terrible his writings, which show monks and nuns as having such low moral standards and so on, and which brought discredit on the church, but says that Boccaccio was repentant for the disedification he had given, bequeathed his precious library to the Augustinian friars of Florence, and asked to be buried in their convent, and that he and Petrarch ended their days piously within a year of each other. See, so many of the stories that Boccaccio wrote represented monks and nuns as so low morally that the Roman Church tried hard to stop their circulation, but they continued to be widely circulated. And eventually, a revised edition of Petrarch was prepared, and in 1573, authorized by the Pope, which retained the indecencies and the impure personages, but substituted laymen for the princes and the monks in the story. It's probably one of the books that has had a greater influence for evil than almost any other in the world's history, because he makes vice attractive. He presents the stories in such a way that they hold the interest, and before one knows it, vicious and low ideas have been implanted in the mind. And so it's rather natural that his work has been translated into many languages and widely distributed. But he stands with Petrarch and Dante as having made Italian a literary language and having had an influence on the beginning of national literature. Now we go over to England. And there in England, I will not take time to more than mention Langland, the author of The Vision of William Concerning Piers the Ploughman, which McSorley says is at once a eulogy of the simple life and a caustic criticism of church and state from the viewpoint of the common man. 30 years ago, practically all scholars adopted the ideas of the higher criticism in relation to Piers the Ploughman and divided it up into several documents, much as they still do with the Penitent. Today, most such scholars, most of them have given up these ideas and hold that William Langland was actually a living man in England who, as one author, wrote this book. When I was in the trial regarding the teaching of anti-Christianity in the state-supported university in Washington, man who taught the course there mentioned, he has written a book on Piers Ploughman, and he sent an article to a book written being published in London on by different authors about different aspects of Piers Ploughman, and the editor there wrote back to him and said, "I'm so surprised to see you still hold to this multiple authorship." He said, "I thought that had been completely given up." But this man, Professor Fowler there, still held very strongly to the idea of the various sources rather than that there was one author. Now, he was one of the figures who were important in this beginning of English literature. But a far greater man was Chaucer. C. Chaucer. Chaucer is included. Geoffrey Chaucer is included in the series called the Great Book Series, where they have a whole volume by him. He lived from 1340 to 1400. McSorley says, Chaucer's Canterbury Tales, so important in early English literature, combined damaging sketches of the clergy with other pictures more creditable to religion. Now, the best known of the work of Geoffrey Chaucer is his so-called Canterbury Tales, which follows the idea that Boccaccio had of getting some men together and having them tell stories. But in Chaucer's story, it is English pilgrims on their way to Canterbury, where the great shrine of Thomas a Becket was, and where Augustine, the one who had brought Christianity to the Anglo-Saxons, had established the headquarters of the religious life in England in his day. And it was very common to have pilgrimages to Canterbury at this time and for some time afterwards. And Chaucer describes the number of pilgrims on their way to Canterbury, and after giving quite a description of them, which gives a very interesting idea of life in England at the time. Then he has each of them tell a story, and these stories vary greatly in the type of story. But Chaucer was a very great and able writer. Unfortunately, the English language has tremendously changed since Chaucer's time. And so it would take most of us a considerable amount of effort to read Chaucer in the original. And in this great book of the Western world, they have Chaucer's writing on one side of the page, and then they have a translation into modern English on the other side. And it's interesting to see how Chaucer speaks about the friars as giving the attitude many people had toward them in his day. Like here, he just starts the description of the friar. He says, a friar there was, a wanton and a merry, a very festive man, and all the orders for is none that can equal his gossip and his fair language. He had arranged full many a marriage of women young, and this at his own cost. Under his own order, he was a noble pope, well-liked by all, and intimate was he with franklins everywhere in the country, and with the worthy women of the town. For at confessing, he'd more power in gown, as he himself said, than a good curate, for of his order he was licentious. He heard confession gently, it was said, gently absolved to, leaving naught of dread. He was an easy man to give penance, when knowing he should gain a good pittance. For to a begging friar, money given is sign that any man has been well shriven. For if one gave, he dared to boast of this, he took the man's repentance not amiss. For many a man there is so hard of heart, he cannot weep, however pains may smart. Therefore, instead of weeping and of prayer, men should give silver to poor friars. And so he continues, and you can see he doesn't have a very high idea of the friar. Then another of these was a pardoner. That is, a man who carried indulgences for sale. And he says, with him there rode a gentle pardoner of Roncesvalles, his friend and his compeer. Straight from the court of Rome had journeyed he. Loudly he sang, come hither, love, to me. The summoner, joining with a burden round, was never horn of half so great a sound. This pardoner had hair as yellow as wax, but lagged a tongue as does a strike of flax. And then it goes on and describes his jovial character and his lightness of attitude. He says, smooth his face as he just had a shave. But in his craft from Berwick unto Ware was no such partner in any place, for in his bag he had a pillowcase, of which he said was our true lady's veil. He said he had a piece of the very sail that good St. Peter had, what time he went upon the sea, till Jesus changed his bent. He had a Latin cross set full of stones, and in a bottle had he some pig's bones. But with these relics, when he came upon some simple parson, then this paragon in that one day more money stood to gain than the poor duke in 2 months could attain. And thus with flattery and such like jakes, he made the parson and the rest his apes. Well, when you hear how he speaks about the pardoner and how he speaks about the friar, you might question whether Chaucer had much use for religion or for the church, but there is one of his characters who is very, very different. He says, there was a man of good man of religion to a country parson, poor, I warrant you. But rich he was in holy thought and work. He was a learned man also, a clerk who Christ's own gospel truly sought to preach. Devoutly his parishioners would he teach. Benign he was, and wondrous diligent, patient in adverse times, and well content if he was oft times proven. All his life he was right loath to curse to get a tithe, but rather would he give in case of doubt unto those poor parishioners about part of his income, even of his goods, and so on, describing the character of this man. He says, this fine example to his flock he gave, that first he wrought, and afterwards he taught out of the gospel, then that text he taught. And it ends up with saying, there is nowhere a better priest, I trow. He had no thirst for pomp or reverence, nor made himself a special spice conscience, but Christ's own Lord of his apostles 12, he taught. But first he followed it himself. And many people in the last couple of centuries have thought that when Chaucer described the parson, he was describing John Wycliffe. Now, he doesn't use the name, and so you cannot prove that that's what he was doing at all. But that is a widespread idea today, that Wycliffe was the man he had in mind. Personally, I would like to hope there were many more whom it would fit, that it wouldn't have to be just John Wycliffe who would fit the fine character that he gives to the country parson, in contrast with his idea of the friars and of the indulgent salesman. But we'll take as case John Wycliffe. McSorley puts Wycliffe simply along with Langland and Chaucer, whom he says these three were prominent in the newly developing field of English prose. But from our viewpoint, Wycliffe is probably the most important figure from our viewpoint in this particular century, in the 14th century. John Wycliffe who lived from 1320 to 1384. He has been called the morning star of the Reformation. He was a scholar. He was connected with a college in Oxford, a teacher there, highly thought of, was sent in a commission by the King of England to go to Avignon to represent England in asking for a dropping of the tribute that the Pope claimed was due from England, since King John had turned the country over 2 centuries before to the Pope. And Wycliffe in Avignon saw the condition of the papacy at the time. He went back to England. He was criticized for some of his views, and representatives of each of the four mendicant orders came to his defense at this time, early in his career. He was then, at first, highly thought of by most people in England, regarded as a great patriotic figure and a great scholar. But Wycliffe, as he went on studying the scripture and trying to make it effective in his life and the life of those around him, gradually changed his ideas on many points. And he published a great many tracts and sermons and theological treatises. McSorley says, Wycliffe, calling the Bible the sufficient rule of faith, helped to prepare a vernacular translation of it, so the common people might discover for themselves the true Christian doctrine. And he has that in quotes. And published also many tracts, sermons, and theological treatises. He began to criticize the claims of the Pope to political power, and then he denied that the Pope would have any right to any primacy of jurisdiction other than that which is based on virtue. He was greatly interested in spreading the knowledge of the gospel, so he began to make a translation into English. We have no evidence that any complete translation of the Bible had been made before. Parts of it had been made into Anglo-Saxon poetry centuries before. But there is no evidence of any complete translation, and no evidence after Wycliffe for over a century of any attempt of others to make a translation into English to distribute. But Wycliffe translated a considerable part out of the Latin Vulgate into English and he got collaborators to work with him and translate the rest. And then he sent men about whom he called his poor preachers. And these men would go, two of them together, and they would travel through England, and where they could get a group of people together, they would read to them from the translation of the Bible. And after a time when church authorities began to make difficulty for some of the knights who were very much attracted by his teaching began to go about at night with the two of the poor preachers, as they called them, and to stand by in his armor as to give them protection as they read from the scripture. Toward the end of his life, Wycliffe began to investigate very carefully some of the widespread doctrine, and in 1380 he wrote Against the Dogma of Transubstantiation. And this hit at the very center of the power of the Roman Church. Because according to its theory, which had developed during the Middle Ages, the priest, by his ordination, had been given the magical power to change the bread and wine into the very body and blood of Christ. And therefore, for salvation, it was necessary that one avail himself of the services of the priest in order to get access to the actual body and blood of Christ. And Wycliffe said that this was all imaginary, that we feed on Christ spiritually, but that the bread and wine remain bread and wine, that there is no such miracle. And this aroused great opposition against him by the ecclesiastical authorities, so that he was put out of Oxford, and there were many ecclesiastical groups which condemned him. So he retired to Lutterworth, a small town, where he carried on services and continued work on translation and sent out his men to spread his ideas. And a considerable group of people followed Wycliffe's teachings. And for some reason, they began to be called the Lollards. I don't think anybody knows why. But for the next two centuries, there were people in England who were called the Lollards, L-O-L-L-A-R-D. And these people were followers of Wycliffe's ideas, students of his Bible, men who were spreading these ideas all they could. But in the next century and a half, they were greatly persecuted. Many of them were burned at the stake. And it was, we will look at that under the next century a bit. It's interesting that one of the nobility, a man who was a close friend of King Henry V before he became king, was a strong Lollard. And after Henry V became king, this man was accused, and Henry felt unable to defend him anymore, so he opposed him, and this man, Sir John Oldcastle, was killed for his following of his teaching. And Oldcastle was so derided as that the general populace of England thought of him as a man of low character. And then when Shakespeare wrote his play about Henry V's youth, which is called Henry IV, he put Sir John Oldcastle into it as a fat, immoral old man, constantly drinking, and a rather clever fellow, quite a comedy character in it, but he used the name Sir John Oldcastle for this, presenting the idea that had become circulated of one of the finest of Wycliffe's followers as a result of the persecution. And of course, by the time of Shakespeare, the Reformation was in full swing in England. Probably Shakespeare didn't even realize that the name he took over, which was so thought of generally, was actually a name of a man who was a martyr for his faith. And so in the second edition of the play, he hunted around and found another name of an old English knight named Falstaff, and he changed the name from Sir John Oldcastle to Sir John Falstaff. And in the epilogue to the play, he has a reference to, he says, this is not Sir John Oldcastle, he died a martyr. But he brings in the name in it. And it simply shows how in the face of persecution, great men can be so completely forgotten And so derided that an utterly false idea of him is maintained. And that doubtless would have been Wycliffe's faith too, had not the Reformation come nearly 150 years later. Now we continue there then tomorrow morning.